is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Week 38 working from home still for so many, I was back at the office. And this week, we've got a special edition of Bloomberg Business Week. We reveal the 2020 Bloomberg 50 list. Now, COVID, a reckoning on race, and a U.S. election made compiling the fourth annual Bloomberg 50 easier in some ways, as many people are doing notable things, but harder in others because, again, many people were doing notable things. So many people standing out in this remarkable and very challenging year. With that in mind, coming up this hour, we'll find out how that list of 50 was compiled. And then we're going to take you to our virtual reveal celebration of these individuals held this week at Bloomberg headquarters in New York City. And that included a conversation with an alum of last year's B50 list, Chipotle Mexican Grill chairman and CEO Brian Nickel. Plus, Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, a champion of relief during the pandemic. We begin, though, this hour with how the Bloomberg 50 comes together. For that, we had to check in with the editor in charge of pulling together the B50 list, Brett Beegan.
Basically, what happens is in the summer, so somewhere early on in the second, early on in the second quarter, I started sending annoying emails out to a lot of reporters, hundreds and hundreds of reporters, basically around the world, saying, you know, who in your area of coverage is really standing out? And do we think that that person or that group is going to be standing out come December? It's sort of a hard calculation in a normal year.
But then throw COVID and an election and everything else on top of it.
That's right. Yeah, it's a miracle we got to 50, Carol.
You did get to 50, and it's an amazing list. I think it's really representative of the type of year we had. Talk to us about the categories, right? You have business, you have politics, you do break it down.
Yeah, we break it down into five categories. So we have business, as you said, politics, entertainment, finance, mm-hmm. and then science and technology, we kind of lumped together into one category.
That was a big one this year. And there's one name that, no doubt about it, I bet from the get-go, you're like, yeah, he's going to be on this list. You know who I'm talking about.
I think you're talking about Dr. Fauci.
Yes,
indeed. If I'm not mistaken. Yeah, there are certain people every year that are sort of no-brainers for this list. And he seemed like one of them. And, you know, in any given year, there's always like one or two people who you think, oh, they'll definitely wind up on the list. But this year, we were pretty certain about that. So, he's on the list. He talked to us. There's 50 entries, mm-hmm. and we do sort of longer in the magazine, do longer profile features on 10 of them. He was one of them. He spoke with our Michelle Faye Cortez.
Yeah. She was one of our internal go-to voices constantly on COVID.
That's right. And he talked to her. In a normal year also, we do a lot of these interviews maybe in early November, and we kind of have a nice, easy landing when it comes to our deadlines. But because of the election this year as well, on top of COVID, we wanted these interviews to be as fresh as possible. So she talked to him really recently.
Politics. Let's go there. I mean, what a year. So crazy. We do have a president-elect, but we still have a president, at least as of this recording, who's still fighting the election outcome. Politics. How did you guys approach it in terms of who you thought were some of the standout voices and had to be on this list?
Yeah. I mean, we take a pretty expansive view of what we consider politics. So we have everyone from actually the Chief Justice on this list, John Roberts, mm-hmm. who in the session that ended in July was in the majority 97% of the time, which is the most he's ever been in the majority.
Surprising, right?
Yeah, surprising. Obviously, things are about to change with Amy Coney Barrett's arrival. We also looked to the founders of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. We actually interviewed all three of them. Rebecca Greenfield talked to the three of them for their take on, you know, a year in which we saw upwards, depending on the estimate, of 26 million people taking part in Black Lives Matter protests. So we talked to them. And we also did an interview with, and I'm going to do my best with his name, is Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya.
I've been
working on that one, Carol. So she is the opposition leader who is currently in Lithuania fighting against Lukashenko in Belarus. Mm-hmm. And she's got a fascinating story. Basically was, stay-at-home mom. Yeah. And her husband was sort of running. And then, lo and behold, she finds herself basically having to sub in for him. and saying, okay, well, I'll do it. And then more and more people start coming to her rallies. Upwards of 60,000 people come to hear her speak. And now she is the principal opposition figure in Belarus. So that really politics, we go all over for that. And some great contributions also from the Mideast and from Africa this year.
Really was a political year like no other, not just in the U.S., but globally. Business. I'm going to highlight one because we talked about him and his company so much on air, John Foley of Peloton. Like, it was one of the stay-at-home, work-from-home winners.
Yeah. I mean, I actually just went on to see how long it might take to get a bike, and they're now upwards of four, I think they were saying 4 to 8 weeks for a bike. So they've had some, you know, supply chain issues, but he's a great example of a business that on, you know, maybe on March 1st, they're doing well, they're happy with how things are going. And by April 1st, it's like, whoa, you know, what's happened here? And how do we profit from this? And how do we not only look to the current moment, but what do we do when this, you know, knock on wood, hopefully ends soon and people can return to their normal lives? Like, how do we continue that growth? So the story of Peloton this year is pretty fascinating. It's funny, in a year where we couldn't see a lot of sports, there are more people from sports on this list than ever before. And that's because, it is kind of wild, but that's because in this absence, basically, a lot of them decided to become really proactive to either help with COVID or the fight for racial justice.
That was features editor and the editor in charge of pulling together the B50 list, Brett Beegan. Check out the cover story on B50, all the write-ups on each member of the list in this week's issue of the magazine. It's online, on newsstands, and on the Bloomberg. Coming up, shares of Chipotle Mexican Grill, man, they are up around 420% since he was named CEO. We will check in with the Chipotle CEO, Brian Nickel, as we continue our special coverage of the B50. That's next on Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
This week, it's all about the Bloomberg 50, the people who were shaping 2020 in the most unexpected ways, from real estate to banking, manufacturing to entertainment, retail to finance, politics to media. And to celebrate the list this year, we tapped an alum of last year's B50 list who continued to make a mark on his companies in this difficult year of 2020. We're talking about Brian Nickel, chairman and CEO of Chipotle Mexican Grill. If anyone knows about how to bounce back from crisis, multiple crises, in fact, that's this CEO. We started with going back to when he took over in 2018.
The very first step was, where are our customers? You know, what are their thoughts, feelings, trust, level of engagement, you know, belief systems. So, you know, step one for me was understanding that. And then also the other piece too was understanding where our employees were. You know, our company, our experience is really driven by our employees. So did they feel like they were on their front foot? Did they feel like they were on their back foot? Because if their experience is, you know, one of defensive, I think our customer feels that it's a defensive experience as well. So we really spent a lot of time, frankly, in the first couple months, diving into understanding both of those things. And frankly, that's what's driven our strategies from day one.
Well, and it's interesting. What did you maybe learn about those first 2 years in the company and dealing with that, and then getting to the current crisis? And again, the customer, right, was worried. Your employees were worried as well.
Yeah. So, you know, look, when we went back, you know, if you rewind the tapes here, a couple of years ago, what consumers were saying to us, or customers were saying to us, is, you know, you guys need to get back to talk about what makes your company special. You know, remind me why I feel good about eating at Chipotle. And, you know, the answer was they felt good about eating at Chipotle because it's real culinary. It's ingredients with integrity. You know, we take a different approach to how we prepare and cook our food. And so that was really what enabled strategy number one, which was around being more visible and, you know, frankly, more loved. And, you know, we really set down that mission of just talking about what makes Chipotle unique. The other thing that we knew we had to do was dial up our culture of safety and wellness. And, you know, our employees, they viewed the practices as more of an initiative, not an ongoing culture. And, you know, in my opinion, it's like, look, we can only have employees working if they're 100% healthy. So it sounds harsh, but we had to install a zero tolerance policy on this, where if you don't do the wellness check and you're not honest on your wellness check, you will lose your job. Like we've got no tolerance for that. And so that was a tough, you know, couple months because, you know, I got a lot of emails from people saying like, I can't believe I lost my job because I didn't do wellness checks.
Wow.
And, you know, it was like, look, this is our culture. If you want to be a part of our company, that's what we do. And also, if you're not truthful, we've got two problems. One, we're a company of high integrity. And two, you know, you're putting our company at risk when you're not truthful, whether or not you have symptoms. And oh, by the way, we have a program where you get paid sick leave. So there's no incentive, you know, to not tell us the truth. So, you know, doing things like that, that materially changed the culture. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes a couple stories being retold about we're really meaning business on this zero tolerance approach to wellness and food safety, as well as then, you know, reminding our consumers why they love Chipotle was at the forefront of what we really instituted day one. And, you know, that just got us back to running great restaurants again. You know, it was like, look, if we know we have healthy employees, we know we're practicing the right protocols, we can focus on making delicious guacamole, terrific chicken, you know, the rice correctly. And every detail matters in our business.
Right. So, you know, this was a crazy year, disruptive. It was an upsetting year, as you well know. You guys, you're very purpose-driven. I mean, it's really in the DNA of your company. How have you as an organization and as a company kind of demonstrated that in 2020?
Yeah, look, you know, I think I'm really proud of how our company has done that. I think we've been tested numerous times on whether or not we were going to be true to our values and our purpose. And I think we've stepped up and done that in every way. You know, so whether it was when the pandemic hit, you know, I had a lot of employees that were worried they were going to lose their job. And then when they realized, you know what, we've got a really healthy balance sheet. Fortunately, we are an essential business. We're going to be able to continue to operate. Not only are you not losing your job, we're going to, you know, because I know other people in your family probably have been impacted, we're going to increase wages for temporary. And we honored first quarter bonuses because, look, January, February, the guys were doing an unbelievable job. March hit and it wiped out what have been their bonus. And that just wasn't the right thing to do. And, you know, fortunately, we were in a position to do it. So we did it. And, you know, it was those types of examples that, you know, I think we stepped up with our values and making those decisions consistent with our values time and time again. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen our Roundup for Real Change program that we've instituted as well. But, you know, we did that because we wanted to participate on a bigger level on these various causes that are important, from, you know, historically Black colleges all the way to the FarmLink program that we're doing right now.
Well, I was going to ask you more specifically about some of the investments you guys did in your people that have benefited the organization. And also, you were focusing on digital when you hit the ground, when you took over the CEO spot, but you really, you know, amped it up big time in terms of what was going on in the pandemic and reaching your customer. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, look, one of the things that was fortunate is we made one of the early decisions to go very aggressive into digital access. And that actually came out of that consumer study I talked about earlier, which is a lot of our younger consumers were saying, geez, I love Chipotle, but why can't I have more access, specifically digital access? And so we went full tilt on putting in that digital experience. And, you know, luckily, we finished implementing all of that in December of 19. And then, you know, March of 20 happens. And, you know, our digital business went from like 5% of sales to about 20% of sales around January, February.
Two.
And then COVID, yeah, and then COVID hit, became 80% of our business, 90% of our business. And now it is about 50% of our business. So, you know, it's going to be a $2.5 billion business this year, which is pretty amazing. You know, if you think
didn't you just open your first digital store too, completely digital?
We did. Yeah, we did, in Highland Falls, New York. And, you know, I'm happy to say that's off to a really good start too. So, you know, there's definitely demand. And the thing I love about that Highland Falls store is if we didn't have a digital only restaurant, we probably wouldn't be in that trade area.
So many brands understanding that customers and their communities demanding more of them going forward. That's Brian Nickel, Chairman and CEO of Chipotle Mexican Grill. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, she is the first International Monetary Fund chief from an emerging market.
We have done in a couple of months so much and so fast. that we really don't have precedent.
We'll hear from the IMF Managing Director, Kristalina Georgieva, managing through the crisis. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
It's a special issue and a special week at Bloomberg Business Week as we highlighted the Bloomberg 50, the people who were shaping this year in the most unexpected ways from all walks of life. And a big one on that list, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva. She's a Bulgarian economist with a doctorate from the country's Karl Marx Higher Institute of Economics. Since the coronavirus pandemic began, the IMF has increased lending to member nations by 50% to $270 billion. Through grants, the fund has helped 29 of the poorest member nations cover their IMF loan payments. And Georgieva is raising money from rich nations for more relief. Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber sat down with the IMF chief for more.
And I can tell you that I came through this year feeling very proud of the staff of the IMF. We have done in a couple of months so much and so fast that we really don't have precedent in our history. We have provided financial support to 83 countries. But most importantly, we moved out of the traditional orthodoxy on what we are supposed to say, which is when you're in trouble, tighten up. My best line probably during this crisis is to policymakers, spend. Keep the receipts, but spend. And I don't think there are many cases in the history of the fund when the managing director would be appealing to countries to spend more. The year, of course, is finishing with a brighter light. Vaccines are coming. But I have no doubt that 2021 is not going to be a simple and easy year either.
So let's talk about that. Let's look ahead to 2021. What are you most concerned about as you look ahead? You mentioned the vaccine. There's some hope there. But what are the areas of that look like, you know, any potential problems that you want the world to be aware of?
Well, the most important policy issue next year is going to be vaccines. Vaccines policy would be at the heart of economic policy. I worry about two things. The first one is that we get carried away. Vaccines are not a magic wand. You do not have them to waive all the impact of the pandemic. There will be scarring, and we will have to manage through not the simplest of years. There will be structural shift. We are saying to policymakers, do not withdraw support prematurely, but eventually there has to be withdrawal of this support, and the risk of doing it either too fast or without thinking of how you cushion the transition for firms and workers is absolutely there. My second worry, that we will miss an opportunity for transformation. 2021 can be a fantastic year for the future of the world. On two counts, climate action, we can boost public investments to accelerate the transition to the new climate economy, generate jobs, accelerate private investments, and do two things at the same time, deal with the COVID crisis and prevent the other crisis from hitting. The second is even more important, and it is dealing with inequalities. After pandemic in the past, we have seen that in evidence, inequality goes up. The risk of inequalities within countries, like a tale of two cities, as Dickens wrote it, and inequalities across countries is very high. And policymakers ought to zero on that. I would be very frank to alert people that there is some space for more progressive taxation, and certainly more space for creatively using public money to help people, to help themselves. We work very closely with US. The US is our largest shareholder. And we are particularly close to our membership at the time of crisis.
That's Kristalina Georgieva, Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. This year, Georgieva has hired two female department heads to replace men, raising the women's share to 40%, 8 of 20. The IMF has also started a YouTube channel with videos on topics such as how to compile macroeconomic statistics, improve central bank law, and use fintech to contribute to financial inclusion. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Our coverage of the Bloomberg 50 continues with The Ones to Watch. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Our coverage of the Bloomberg 50 continues, and when we pull together this year's list, we also take a look back at some notable alums of past B50 lists that included former Georgia House Minority Leader Stacey Abrams. She definitely stood out for lining up people to go out and vote in this year's presidential election. Also, Jose Andres, founder of World Central Kitchen, making sure people got fed during the pandemic. Also, Fed Chief Jay Powell and Kathy Wood, CEO of ARK Investment. Again, check out the magazine for more on the reasons why. We also like to give you a heads up on some people we know you'll want to keep an eye on this coming year. It's what we call the ones to watch. Bloomberg 50 editor Brett Biegun is back with fashion designer Tia Adeola, writer and publisher of Notes on the Crisis Nathan Tankis, and chef and author Kwame Anuache.
Tia, if you could, we'll start with you. Just walk us through what the pandemic has been like for you.
Oh, God. It started off pretty rough for me personally. I'm just going to be honest. I left New York right at the beginning of the pandemic. So in March, I went to Nigeria thinking, you know, I don't know what's going on. I'm going to go back to my family for like 2 weeks, come back to New York. But then I got stuck there and they closed the airport indefinitely. And, you know, my brand is based here. My studio's here. My team's here. And so I sort of sulked for the first 2 weeks, and my mom was kind of like, you're a designer, like design something for the pandemic. And so I started looking back at like my fashion history references and like what face masks were looking like during that time period. And I sort of just started coming up with some face mask ideas and like put them out on social media. And people reacted really well to them. They sort of went viral and just sort of figured out other ways to be of help and of use during the pandemic. So I had a ton of contests where I had my audience tag family members who are nurses, doctors, and sent them face masks, professional medical face masks that were kind of looked kind of cool that they would like want to wear for 24 hours. So yeah, I would say my main thing during the pandemic has been working on face masks and just like long-term plans, long-term collaborations, going with the flow.
Great, thank you so much. Kwame, tell us what you've been up to in the last 9 months and accomplishments that you'd love to highlight as well.
I've been trying to stay sane for the last 9 months. You know, first of all, I wanna shout out that Nyjah's in the house. You know, we got two people here from Nigeria, so that's always nice to see.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean? But I think, you know, I'll use the buzzword, pivot. We've all had to pivot in this time, and maybe it's our mentality. We're pivoting what we are willing to sacrifice for our happiness, you know, how we're pivoting in that regard. And then, obviously, you know, we're on Bloomberg, so our business, how are we pivoting within that? So for me, it mainly started in that order. It was like my mindset. You know, I had to understand that this wasn't going anywhere and I could either sit back and let and go on a ride or I can jump into the driver's seat. So I jumped into the driver's seat. You know, I left my restaurant. It didn't really make sense to operate a restaurant in this time frame. You know, I'll be back with a vengeance when we can have a full dining room inside and outside. I started doing a lot of stuff on social media and getting brand partnerships. And then I started turning toward media in general. You know, I have the movie that's in the works, so that got me in the rooms of a lot of production companies. So I started pitching them ideas for TV shows, you know, digital series, unscripted, scripted. I started doing research on how to write. I started taking acting classes. So I was able to really thrive during this time because I just didn't stop. And I kept trying to do things. I understood that we had a lot of time and opportunity and space. And we were also able to omit things that weren't bringing us joy, that were kind of arduous and taking away from who we really were. And there's no better time than today that I've realized, especially during this pandemic, to do exactly what you want to do in life.
That's great. Thank you. Nathan, take us through what you've been up to.
Yeah, so my experience of the pandemic has been kind of strange because I think in some ways uniquely strange because it's been, frankly, career making for me in that, you know, at early March, let's say like March 8th, March 9th, I started realizing what was happening, started paying attention more to what was going on, the crisis. You know, I work on economic policy in general, but don't necessarily work on the week to week. But, you know, there's certain things that happened that made me stand up and take notice of what was going on a little bit before everyone else was catching up. And I realized that this was, you know, going to be a gigantic crisis. And that we, you know, early on, I think a little bit before other people started calling it a depression, thought of it as a depression. And I realized there weren't really people who were writing about it. You know, very, very rapidly, especially, you know, the panoply of new programs that we were getting, the CARES Act, but also the Federal Reserve's crisis facilities. And I saw an opportunity to just write about that all the time. You know, that first month I wrote 22 pieces within a month. I was publishing a piece basically every weekday. And that was able, you know, that was an opportunity to really make my career and get a lot of attention for a lot of knowledge that is, you know, most useful in a crisis, but kind of sometimes can lay dormant during in other periods. And so was able to build my own newsletter, which is very successful, and get a following, including a policy following, including, you know, people within the U.S. government and within the next U.S. government.
Thanks so much. I just want to ask you, you know, you all work in very different fields. Internally, I've been referring to this as the fashion, finance, and food panel, right? And you all work in very different fields, but the thing that you have in common is that you're all young and that you're facing this pandemic really at the beginning of your careers, or let's say in the first quarter of your careers. And I'm just curious, do you think that that has made this harder or easier than if you were slightly more advanced in your careers? Kwame, if you don't mind, maybe we'll start with you on this one.
I mean, I think youth is relative and it's a mindset. So I think that there are people that are, you know, just starting out when they're 40 or 50. And there are people like me that I started when I was 5 years old. So in terms of my professional history and length of time, I think that I have a lot of experience. You know, I have some more experience than people that are older than me, and in different facets. And I think once you understand, especially within every craft but cooking, that you know nothing, then that kind of like broadens your mind to soak in so many different things. You know, I've been a personal chef. I've been a chef on a boat. I've opened a restaurant. I've written a book. I'm just finished writing another book. So like once this thing hit, it was like, okay, well, I can no longer cook for people anymore. How can I use my other assets? And I think as a business, you need to look at always diversifying your streams of income and just diversifying who you are as a person so that if something hits where I can no longer serve people directly, then do I switch to a ghost kitchen? Do I do things online? Do I do classes? Do I do more writing? Why don't I try to sign a book deal within this time? And that's really where it came from. So I don't really look at my youth as something that that deters me or gives me an advantage. I would say my professional prowess is something that I use to my advantage more than others.
Nathan, so take us through, you know, obviously you said that the pandemic really afforded you an opportunity to launch your business. Do you think that that was easier or harder given your age?
I mean, I think in certain senses it was easier. I mean, more flexibility. You know, if I had been in a conventional job, I wouldn't have been able to put everything aside and devote, you know, at least the beginning, 80 to 100 hours a week writing and thinking and reading about the crisis. So it was definitely an advantage in that sense. And definitely the motivation, the drive to do it. I can't speak for anyone older, but I'm not necessarily something that someone 45 or 50 would have done, even if they had the career flexibility to do it. So I mean, that's how I kind of think about it.
So, Nathan, how did you think? I'm just curious. How did you say? When was the moment where you said, "I have a voice on this, and I think I'm someone that other people with a lot of advanced degrees should be listening to"? On the one hand, that's quite a sort of like moment to reach. But on the other hand, obviously you've been successful at it. When did you realize that, hey, I got something to say here?
I think it was really just that no one else was writing about it. I was being encouraged, you know, I my big moment has been this year, but I've already kind of built a large network. I have a lot of friends, including Bloomberg journalist friends. Joe Weisenthal was extremely supportive of me and my career, and basically tweeted out every piece I wrote for the first month.
That's Bloomberg 50 editor Brett Biegun with fashion designer Tia Adeola, writer and publisher of Notes on the Crisis Nathan Tankus, and chef and author Kwame Onyewache. That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, our special coverage of the Bloomberg 50 from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser. More ahead in our next hour, including highlights from my panel at the B50 virtual reveal, an all-star lineup of CEOs and senior leaders talking about customer centricity and running a business where the customer comes first. On that panel, the CEO of Chewy, Adyen, and GSK Healthcare, the president of Nordstrom and Fila North America, the head of global operations at Groupon, and Salesforce's chief growth evangelist. Plus, we check in with the director of the most watched documentary in ESPN history. We're talking about The Last Dance. That's coming up on Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Hello, I'm Carol Masser. Coming up in the second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, we continue coverage of the Bloomberg 50, this week's cover story and special issue. The list compiled with the input from Bloomberg's 2,700 journalists and analysts to name the people shaping 2020 in the most unexpected ways. And speaking of that, coming up in just a moment, we've got an all-star lineup of CEOs and senior leaders talking about customers during the health crisis and how to put their changing needs and demands first. And let's get to that panel. In this segment, we hear from Jennifer Estabrook, president of Fila North America, Brian McNamara, GSK Consumer Healthcare CEO, and Sumit Singh, Chewy CEO and director.
I'm going to start with Brian at GSK Healthcare because healthcare wellness never mattered as much as it did today. Brian, what are you seeing from your customers, or what did you learn from your customers during this crisis?
Yeah, and you're right. We're in the consumer healthcare business. So the trends and the impact of COVID-19 on consumers and how they think about health and wellness has been pretty incredible. And, you know, when we looked at the world pre-COVID, something like 77% of the world's population was interested in more proactively managing their health. But that's been completely turbocharged. The idea of going into this health crisis healthier and having a much better chance of coming out the other end, I think is something that's really been imprinted in the consumer psyche now. So we're seeing a big shift to this idea of consumers really proactively managing their health, if that's around immunity products or vitamins, minerals, and supplements to help manage their balance and their intake of nutrients, to how they're actually operating beyond the categories that we work in, you know, of how they're own, managing their own health and their weight. So it's been a really significant shift.
All right. So we just heard from Brian. Summit, come on in on this, because the other thing that I noticed during the pandemic, as I walked my dog every night on really quiet, dark streets, but there were Chewy boxes at the curb everywhere. The customer cared about their pets.
You know, I mean, this is a time when we saw customers really lean in with engagement, because it's a time of solitude in some way. And it's a time when relationships matter even more. And when everybody was in their own houses, unable to travel, I think pets kind of sort of brought us together. And that actually formulated, believe it or not, the central theme of one of our campaigns that we ended up launching across Zoom, gathering people across North America, bringing them together from different kind of ethnicities and origins and race and diversity to be able to just, you know, formulate a bond or bring forward a bond that was formed on the relationships, the fact that they had pets. And so, you know, one, we really saw that. Two, what we saw is, you know, we're a young company. We're 10 years this year, and we've grown, you know, at the end of this year to be close to $7 billion in revenue, 20,000 people. But these people, our team members, have never actually worked remotely. And so one of our greatest challenge was, how do you take a workforce that's not enabled to, you know, who was in office one day and then the global pandemic shows up and you have to take a, let's say, a customer service task force that is all North America 24/7 and overnight migrate them to work from home. So we've, you know, we've had those kind of sort of internal challenges that we've navigated, keeping health and safety of team members up front, as well as figuring out business continuity while providing customers an experience that has been, you know, completely continuous or completely coherent. And one of the best parts of the pandemic for us has been, or at least a testament to our brand, has been wherever we took a bit of a pause to understand expectations and reset our experience so that we could be at par or better than we normally are, our loyal customers jumped in to the rescue of the brand. And you know, you could see this on social media going on, right, where when our service levels degraded at the peak of the pandemic, let's say delivery, and new customers were jumping in going, you know, we aren't hearing enough from the company. Loyal customers, the older cohorts were jumping in and saying, hey, this company's always been kind of pro-customer and customer centricity at the core. So, you know, why don't we kind of give the company a break? And that was just awesome to see. I can go on and on, but I don't want to ramble here.
Well, I'm gonna jump around. I want to bring in some of the kind of the other retail brands. Jennifer, come on in. What happened to Fila and the Fila customer during the crisis?
Well, interestingly, we have two levels of customer. We have our sell-in customer, that's the retailers, because we're mostly a wholesale business. Right. And then we had actually pivoted at the end of last year and said, we've got to start building our direct-to-consumer. So on the sell-in side, we had a lot of retailers cancel orders, ask for payment extensions. And so we worked with them. We wanted to, you know, in March, you didn't know if people were going to survive, if the world was going to survive. We've never, as you said, there isn't any playbook. And so we did, even though we're a much smaller company than many of our retailer partners, we did everything we could to support the big ones and the small ones, payment extensions, whatever they needed, if they wanted to cancel orders, if they wanted to push them out. And it was the spirit of, we knew that if the retailers went into bankruptcy, we wouldn't survive. That would also be the end of us, because you need people, we need them to sell our product. So we really felt like part of our mission was to do what we needed to do and work with them, and not, and there were, you know, brands, some of our largest competitors that said, no way, you're not extending, you're not canceling, you're not doing anything. They didn't, you know, they just didn't work with the customers. So that was one way that we helped our retailers. And then in terms of the consumer, we had a little bit of luck, because we pivoted at the exact right time.
That comment, that last comment from Jennifer Estabrook, president of Fila North America. Coming up, our panel continues. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
continue our special coverage of the Bloomberg 50 and my panel, where we talked with a bunch of CEOs and presidents and leaders of companies where they were talking about customer centricity. In this excerpt, we hear from Pete Nordstrom, President and Chief Brand Officer at Nordstrom. Peter van der Duis, he is the co-founder and CEO of Adyen. Barbara Weiss, Senior Vice President and Head of Global Operations, Groupon. And Jennifer Estabrook, President of Fila North America.
What we started to do, first of all, we had planned a lot of experiential events. Everything was canceled, including the first professional sporting event that was canceled was the BNP Paribas Open, which we sponsor. So, and everyone is in a panic. So we said, you know what, we're going to use our tennis athletes to convey this message of stay home. And the athletes were from all over the world. So we pivoted to help people, to engage them, to amuse them and humor them. And then from a product standpoint, we quickly pivoted to get, because just as the pandemic was hitting here, our sourcing operations were reopening in China. And so we were able to quickly pivot and provide the comfort, cozy products that people wanted at home. And because we were building our online business, we were able to see from the data what people were searching for and what they wanted. And so, you know, throughout this, we've tried to engage them, keep them calm, keep them do public service announcements, stay home. Right. This summer, we did a campaign to wear a mask. And it has helped raise the profile while doing some good in the world. And I think all of our, even the retailers, we had a couple ones that filed in bankruptcy during the period, but everybody, when it was over, said, thank you so much for working with us and keeping us going.
I feel like community collaboration, digitization was a big couple of the themes. Peter from Nordstrom, come on in, because the retail world really, it was just, you know, smack down, shut down. It was really hard. I know your digital sales, I think, were up like 37% from last year in your most recent update to Wall Street. What happened to your customer initially?
Oh, gosh, all this stuff that I'm hearing from everyone else in the panel, it's all super familiar. We're all in the same boat here. Yeah. There was so much uncertainty that I think that was probably the main thing. You know, it was all new. It was all uncertain. And so we found ourselves really in the first time having an existential threat to our business. And we've been around 119 years. And I mean, personally, I've never really been involved in managing for cash flow and liquidity and all this stuff. It sounds kind of obvious in business, but that's just not the position we've been in. So, you know, internally, we had to really think about those things. But the thread that was going to pull us through, and I'm sure everyone in the panel would say the same thing, is the relationships you have with your customers, and that all the things you can do, whatever touch points you have, to engender trust and confidence. And luckily, we've got a lot of loyal customers, and we were able to pivot and find new ways to how to serve them. You know, luckily, we have a big digital business, and so that was pretty natural. That happened pretty easily. But, you know, it was so disruptive, and it continues to be. And there's a lot to be learned from that. And I guess the silver lining of all of it, it definitely reinforces, I think, to the theme you talked about at the beginning, is like, if you don't have customer centricity in terms of the way that you're viewing this, you're really going to be in trouble. And I think it kind of helped us redouble our efforts about putting the focus in the right place.
Peter from Adyen, come on in. You too saw some customer behavior change as a result of the pandemic, and your customers are other businesses, Uber, Tiffany, McDonald's, Groupon, Spotify, Microsoft. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, for us, it was, we were in the situation that as we have offices around the world, we had the Shanghai office, who was hit by the pandemic much earlier, but also got out of it much earlier. So our first question was, what do merchants actually expect from us? So for merchants, we help them with the payment. We help them with everything around their consumer to make sure that they can compete on knowing everything about their customer, on the data around it, on making the payment really easy. And what we found out in Shanghai, we already learned our lessons there, that merchants were thanking us for being very proactive during the approach, because we also felt a little bit like, hey, we are doing relatively well, a lot of online volume, so we see more volume coming in. But we reached out to all our merchants through account management, and you see that during a crisis, that is really appreciated. There can be the merchant that says, look, I've other things on my mind. But what we found out, there are merchants which are doing a lot of refunds. And then our pricing was never intended for merchants which unfortunately had to refund 90 or 100% of their sales of the last month. So that stuff we came into. A lot of merchants were selling much more online or didn't have, were thinking about an online presence, but didn't have it. So we were developing new products with them to be able to get to pay through an email so that their customers could still shop with them. So it was a very intense time, and still is, with projects being canceled, but also suddenly new projects being started. Because what we typically saw in retail is that we had merchants where their online volume totally compensated for their stores. So first you, of course, had to dip. Consumers could not come into store. But if they also had an online presence, you saw a full compensation of that in the online world. And then when the stores opened, you saw a lot of that volume coming back through store, but actually the total was more than 100%. So some of that volume in new patterns was actually sticking. And that's what we still see, that the total for those merchants is still more than where they were before the pandemic.
Barbara, I want to bring you into this. You see a lot at Groupon, and you've been going through your own restructuring, but you've got B2B and B2C customers. You work with a lot of small businesses. We have talked a lot about the hit that small businesses have had, certainly with the shutdown of the economy. So what have you seen kind of from that two-sided marketplace that you've got?
The main difference with the other panelists is like we really have like a two-sided marketplace, and obviously our core business is being local and local merchants being hit very hard this year. So very similar to what other panelists have been talking about, which is really just listening to what their needs were. So our businesses are like health and beauty, restaurants, we talked about this, and also everything around leisure and activities obviously hit very hard. So what I would say is like one, the agility, just moving very fast and changing based on their needs. So similar to what Peter was saying, is just helping them with tools, helping them manage capacity with the new restrictions. So we give them like some booking tools so that they can manage the capacity that has been reduced given the sanitary restrictions.
That last comment from Barbara Weiss, Senior Vice President and Head of Global Operations, Groupon. Coming up, our panel continues. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. It's all about the Bloomberg 50. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
We're back with more of our special coverage of the Bloomberg 50, bringing you highlights from a panel I hosted at the event. In this segment, we hear from Pete Nordstrom, President and Chief Brand Officer at Nordstrom, and Sumit Singh, Chewy CEO and Director.
You know, one of my personal greatest learnings when I joined Chewy was, you know, I was born and brought up in a cost-constrained environment. And when I came to Chewy, I really knew how to drive efficiency in a business. And customer centricity was always in the back of the mind. But what I saw at Chewy actually blew me away. My first couple of weeks, I sat down with my customer service teams, and I spent some time there. And customer service, by the way, still directly reports to me. And here's the reason for that. What I found was that we didn't recognize customer service as a cost center at all. And that was, first of all, there was a bit sort of bit counterintuitive to me. And I was like, okay, I think there's something here. Let me listen a little bit harder. And what I found was that when we said, hey, customer service is an engagement mechanism for us or a revenue generation center, I started listening even harder. And we're all data-driven leaders. And so went back and sort of, you know, went back and got some data. And what we can say via data is the level of investment that we put behind our customer service, the social media teams that we run within our customer service, our policies that we communicate via the experiences that we build, or the pure investments that we make in delivering a high touch personalized service that is almost unheard of in today's world. What's an example of that? Even today, at the scale that we're operating at, we don't have any automated voice lines. We have human beings picking the phone. Our customer service agents aren't subjected to any metrics like average handle time or productivity. They essentially are encouraged to interact with the customer in a happy, friendly manner and take care and solve the problem, regardless of how long it takes. Wow. And what that's done for us is we can show via data that the cohort of customers that interacts with our customer service has greater lifetime value and greater retention versus the customers who haven't been exposed yet to our friendly, personalized, or high touch customer service. So, you know, from our standpoint, investing in experience building and customer service in some way is a way to generating profits. So the two are actually not separate or not counter or competitive with each other at all, in my opinion.
Peter at Nordstrom, you want to come in on this? Because I think about, you know, I think for such a long time, Nordstrom has been really thought of as that customer-centric experience. And I'm just curious, how do you measure it? How do you make sure you're doing the right things in terms of what your customer really wants?
Well, I like that question about if it's a competing agenda, whether you're doing stuff for customers or shareholders. I think that's great. And actually, one of the things we talked about recently was that when you do things that solve problems for customers and makes them feel good, it's in the best interest of shareholders. So I think that that's important. I mean, you know, look, we're a public company and we know we're accountable for those results. But, you know, you also, and a lot of people have talked about it here, how to engage your people and your teams to, you know, really be the face of the brand. And you're not going to win the hearts and minds with your team by getting behind this big rallying cry of shareholder value or, you know, economic profit, or, I mean, it's not that those things are wrong and they're fine principles, but you got to find things that can galvanize people on a mission that everyone can buy into and play a role in. And for us, you know, to keep the customer stuff front and center, you know, I think if you're a good business, if it's good for customers, you got to figure out how you can make money and after you figure out what's great for customers. So, you know, it's just been core to our DNA that we stick to that. I mean, obviously there's a reactive part of what we do and having to respond what customers want, but we want to try to lead to and just try to anticipate some of those things as well. And I think one of the things that helps us do that is, you know, how competitive the marketplace is. There's so many great companies out there really mm-hmm. doing innovative and interesting things that I think that helps keep us moving forward and acting in ways that's in the best interest of customers.
Diversity, inclusion, how has that changed the conversation at Nordstrom because of this year?
Well, I think Brian mentioned it earlier. It's been really eye-opening, I think, to go there and to be vulnerable and to open yourself up to feedback. You know, we're all in the customer business and I think, you know, really naturally inclined to be attuned to what's going on with customers. And as such, you know, an inclusive environment is the, you know, the best environment to have. You're trying to, you know, draw a lot of customers, but it just was made so clear of how much more there was behind this. And if you're not open to really hear it and understand from everybody, then you wouldn't know. And it created an opportunity for us to have a lot of great feedback that I think is going to serve us really well. It's, you know, it's certainly the right thing to do in terms of how you treat employees and customers.
That last comment from Pete Nordstrom, President and Chief Brand Officer at Nordstrom. What an amazing lineup of leaders and CEOs and talking about the changing customer landscape, how they were impacted by the pandemic, and how these companies are innovating going forward. Straight ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, it is the most watched documentary ever at ESPN. That's what you get when you follow one of the most iconic athletes in history. We hear from the director of The Last Dance. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
We're going to wrap up this week with more from our coverage of the Bloomberg 50. It was one of the most talked about series of the year. And no, it isn't Tiger King, but you could find it on Netflix after its debut on ESPN. We're talking about The Last Dance. We all needed content during the pandemic, and many found it in the 10-part series that became the most watched documentary in ESPN history. The Last Dance won the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Documentary or Nonfiction Series at the 72nd Primetime Emmy Awards. It was directed by 7-time Emmy-winning director and producer Jason Hare. I caught up with Jason at our B50 virtual reveal to talk about directing that documentary about Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls' 1997-1998 championship season.
I said yes before they finished the sentence when they asked me if I'd be interested in doing the project. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, so Michael Jordan's career and the Bulls' dynasty parallels my trajectory as a sports fan and as a pop cultural fanatic. I was 8 years old when he came into the league, and that was 84, and I was a senior in college in 98 when this season was filmed, the Last Dance season was filmed. So that kind of took me through my childhood. So for them to even mention that name or this subject, it was an easy yes. What wasn't easy was that it took them 2 years to get to the starting line in a business sense, because you had four major entities, multi-billion dollar entities in Jump 23, which is Michael's company, the NBA, ESPN, and Netflix, to all get to the same table and to agree logistically, creatively, financially, that they were going to collaborate on something like this. It took 2 full years. I actually did a full-length documentary while they were negotiating this, and then I came back and the timing worked out. So we started in January of 2018 officially, and we finished it up while you were watching it.
Well, so tell me about, I think when you described to me getting these four behemoths together, you know, Netflix, ESPN, Michael Jordan's company, and then the NBA, that it was like turning an oil tanker. What were you privy to in terms of the negotiations? Because first of all, I mean, they were, I guess, maybe once or twice all at the same table, but a lot of it was done virtually.
Well, that was afterwards. The negotiations I'm not privy to at all, because like I said, I was working on a different project. And when they finally had their ducks in a row and everything was figured out logistically and the budget was figured out and we could go and start to shoot, it's a challenge always to answer to one distributor, be that a network or a production right. company, what have you. This was four distributors and the biggest distributors you could possibly imagine all coming into the same virtual room like we're talking right now. I am a face-to-face person, and I always wanted, I don't like 15 voices on a phone. I don't really like 3 voices on a phone. So I was always endeavoring to get people to the same table so that we could all sit there and sketch things out, literally on a pad or on an overhead or show slides or things like that. We only had 2 times in the entire making of this doc when we got all of the parties involved into one room. To hash out exactly what our likes and dislikes were about other people's visions at the table. So there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And in this case, it actually, there's the DNA of each of those four entities is in the finished product.
Right, and you can definitely see it. What happened though, because it was originally supposed to air right in the summer of 2020, and then all of a sudden with COVID and everybody kind of just, you know, dying for looking for content, you guys sped up the release date. What was that like?
Yeah, we knew, I think March 11th was what's called the Rudy Gobert game. That's when Rudy Gobert tested positive and they canceled on site just before tip-off the Jazz and Oklahoma City Thunder game. And after that, that's the last time I saw my staff was the day after that, because very quickly mm-hmm. the lockdown went back to New York. And I was thinking, because this is supposed to air in conjunction with the NBA Finals. June 2nd is when it was supposed to air. So I was thinking, okay, the NBA Finals are now not going to happen until at least in our minds, it was like they're going to delay them maybe a month, because I think at that point, none of us had really any idea how severe this was. And I was thinking, oh, we have an extra month to do this. And then as the days passed by that weekend, I realized, oh, no, they're going to want to move this up almost 2 months. So we ended up settling on April 19th as our premiere date. So we were literally finishing episodes 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 as episodes 1 and 2 were airing on April 19th. So it was normally you have some time to shoot and then edit and then relax and then you do a little bit of promotion and you can watch it at home with your families. We were watching on one screen and editing another episode for next week on another.
Yeah, no relaxing here. So, all right, I know everybody's waiting to talk to us about the interviews. My understanding is, I think you told me you did 105 interviews, 106 shoots. Tell us about those interviews. They were with some pretty amazing people.
Yeah, it was, we had an embarrassment of riches. I mean, it's a testament, first of all, to Michael actually diving in and committing to this and his team committing to this, that these people who were featured in this doc, a lot of them get these kind of phone calls all the time to be a part of a story like this or to tell the Michael Jordan story or the story of 80s and 90s basketball. And so many times that oftentimes they don't even pick up the phone. So Michael and his team drafted a letter and said, Jason and his team are going to be calling you. Michael is participating in this one. Essentially, this is the real thing. We're actually doing mm-hmm. this now. So then that greased the wheels for myself and my team to be able to call people. And we had already been vetted because Michael had already notified all of the parties. We gave them a list of about 150 people that we might be contacting. And then they reached out to those 150. So you know, I mean, to sit down and experience talking to these people, I wouldn't even know where to begin if you said who's the most interesting interview you conducted, because it goes all the way from Barack Obama and President Clinton to Michael himself, and his interview, you know, dwarfed any expectations that I had or hopes that I had. It was exceeded those expectations, all the way down to Steve Kerr's mom, who was one of the most impressive people that I've ever met, and Michael's mom herself as well. So we had 105, we interviewed 105 people. There were 106 shoots, as you said, and there were very few, if any, duds in that entire bunch.
Well, I did ask you when we spoke yesterday, I said, so which interview stuck out? And you said, okay, the boring answer is Michael, but it really was the most incredible interview. You spoke with him 3 times.
Yeah, we spoke with him in January 2018, and then in 2019, we spoke with him in May and December. He was only contracted for 2 interviews for his involvement in this, and we quickly realized that the interviews were going so well, they took longer than I thought they would, and by the time the second interview ended, we only had material for 6 or 7 episodes. I still hadn't gotten to episodes 8, 9, and 10 in our storyline. So he and his team were gracious enough to grant us a few more hours for me to sit there and bug him with questions. But he came in that first day, and it was very, very clear. I didn't know what Michael to expect. I didn't know if he was going to get up after a half hour and say, that's all I'm giving you. I didn't know if he was going to be right. offended by some of the questions, or if he was going to try and direct me in some places. It was suspenseful, to say the least.
Well, Jason, tell me about, because I asked you specifically, because I was, you know, going through some of the clips and stuff, and there's that one where he's like in the white outfit and the white background, he's got a drink next to him and he's got a cigar. You said that when you walked in, you knew it was going to be a different kind of interview.
Yeah.
Once he was kind of relaxed and, yeah.
I'm used to seeing him. At that point, we had done 2 years of research before we rolled cameras on that interview. So I had seen just about every Michael Jordan interview that had ever been conducted. And what I really wanted to do with his interview and some of the other main characters was make this seem a little bit more relaxed in a home setting. Oftentimes it was their home. Phil Jackson was his backyard. To get to the real person rather than the icon that we're used to seeing either pregame or postgame in a scrum of media. So for Michael to sit down in that chair and kind of kick his legs out and be really relaxed, he had just played golf that day. He had a cigar. He had a drink next to him. It was clear that this was going to be almost kind of a window into what it's like to hang out with Michael Jordan rather than this rigid interview that he normally does for other events.
So tell me, you did ask him to why he wanted to do this documentary now. What did he say?
Well, originally I asked, the first time I met him was 2 years before we shot, and I asked him, why do you want to do this? And he said, I don't. And I said, why not? And he said, because when people see this footage, it's very raw, it's very revealing, and, you know, I don't think that they're going to have the context to understand why I was acting that way sometimes towards my teammates, towards my opponents. I mean, as anyone who watched the series knows, he can be a vicious guy and a ruthless competitor. So I tried to impress upon him in that first brief meeting that you're going to have 10 hours of context to provide these viewers. This is actually the time where you can silence all of the critics that you think you have in regards to these topics and others. So by the time he got there 2 years later, I think it was 20 minutes into that first interview, I asked him about arriving in Chicago as a rookie. And I said that one writer called that 84 Bulls team the Traveling Chicago Bulls Cocaine Circus. And Michael threw his head back and laughed. I had never heard that laugh come out of him in the research I'd done or in the time that I had spent with him in person. So that would have been enough for him to validate that statement just with his laughter. He's very adept at dodging a question like that. Not only did he not dodge it, he laughed and validated it and then went on to give us an anecdote about his time there as a kid coming straight from Chapel Hill and witnessing all of these things. So we knew very early on that he was both feet in on this.
Some of the episodes for The Last Dance broke viewership ratings for ESPN, becoming the most watched ESPN documentary ever. Gotta say, it was a lot of fun to talk with director Jason Hare, 7-time Emmy-winning director and producer. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio, our special Bloomberg 50 issue. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser. Be sure to tune in daily to Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday, starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. You can also hear more of our Bloomberg Business Week conversations. Download them at Bloomberg.com. Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also watch us on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. And be sure to check out our Bloomberg Businessweek Extra podcast. It's our Businessweek talks this week featured in the magazine. We take you to one of this year's successful IPOs, which is up around 200% since its debut on the New York Stock Exchange in September. It's the company that has patented a synthetic version of the active ingredient in so-called magic mushrooms for use in treatment-resistant depression. We talked with Compass Pathways Chairman, CEO, and co-founder George Goldsmith. Bloomberg Businessweek, it's available on newsstands now, online, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Have a safe weekend, everyone. This is Bloomberg.